Jim.
Hey, Catherine.
Another day.
Yes.
The days keep happening.
Are you less tired today?
Yeah, I took a nap in the middle of the day yesterday.
Must be nice.
But everything just keeps happening is the problem. You catch up on your sleep and then you wake up and then more things have happened.
Yeah.
Today we found out that more than 3 million people have filed for unemployment this week. New Orleans is seeming like it's becoming one of the epicenters of this.
Oh, no.
And I think there's concern about the whole South, what might happen there and how prepared the South is. Anyway, so those are the things that are happening right now, unfortunately.
And we have on our staff, Ed Yong, who's just published a huge piece about what will happen and how this will go.
Mm-hmm.
And so he could inform us a bit, maybe,
mm-hmm.
if he's willing to talk with us.
Well, yeah, we asked him. So
he's literally
Hello?
Waiting on the line, isn't he?
Hey.
Hey. Yes, I totally forgot that I am muted. Hello.
Did you just think we were just ignoring you?
And... I know. It's like, yeah, they seem really chilled. I feel like I went full British and just sort of sat there for about a minute going, okay.
How are you doing, Ed?
I'm all right.
So, Ed, you have just yesterday published a piece. Why don't you tell us the title?
It's called How the Pandemic Will End.
So this is something, I mean, we've been certainly getting a lot of questions, and I have questions, how will this end? But can you both talk me through this? Because it feels like we're asking the question, how does this end? But has it even started yet?
That's a really, really good question. I definitely think we're not even close to the worst of it yet, sad to say. Cases are still growing. We're already seeing signs of healthcare workers and hospitals being overwhelmed, and those signs will become worse and more abundant, I think, as the coming days and weeks press on. You're absolutely right. We need to steel ourselves for things getting worse, while at the same time also, I think, preparing and fighting for measures that might make things better. And I think, you know, it's always perilous to look far into the future, especially for something as fast moving as this. I think there are two reasons why it's important right now. First, the choices we make immediately, like not in the usual timeframes for crises, like within days or weeks, like literally right now, those choices are going to have a huge difference on how well the country fares in the future. And also, the second reason, which is a little more complex, is that even people who have been thinking about pandemics had not anticipated some of America's failures. And if we are to have any hope of averting the worst case scenarios, I think we just need to become much better about imagining the worst and the best possible futures.
Right. So it's important actually to think about the end now because we have some control over it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, both of y'all have basically, I don't want to say predicted, but both of you have been talking about this for months, if not years, about this being a possibility. Did you both anticipate how this would go, or what's been surprising to you?
So let me put it this way. I think it was very clear that a pandemic was inevitable.
It wasn't clear to me.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay. So
I got to say, this has been a big shocker.
Okay.
For me.
You should listen to episode one if you haven't.
Right. Okay. So look, I wrote a piece in 2018 about pandemic threats for the Atlantic. That is not the only piece that was out there. That a catastrophe of this kind would happen was absolutely inevitable. But that being said, I and everyone else I spoke to, almost to a person, thought that the United States was better prepared than it has proven to be. It has so substantially underperformed. It is still, I think, hard for people to believe, including the experts I've talked about who foresaw that something like this would happen.
Well, what about you? I mean, is it hard for you to believe?
I think the extent to which the United States has flinched in the face of this virus has been truly surprising. I feel like the view that I found most helpful in framing the national posture towards this crisis came from a man named Ron Klain, who was the so-called Ebola czar, the man who coordinated America's response to the West African Ebola outbreak of 2014. He pointed out that if you look at the countries that have done a really good job at handling this pandemic, so places like South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, not only did those countries do specific things like widespread testing, but it's also not a coincidence that a lot of them had firsthand experience with SARS in 2003. Mm. And that, I think, is important. The countries that have some experience of what a very fast-moving, possibly pandemic respiratory virus can do to a population have a sense of how to react. They have this sort of like a legacy of medical know-how and a sort of national readiness that I think we in America and perhaps a lot of other industrialized countries just simply lack. Ron said, and I think very rightly, like one of the most common sentences uttered in America today is, "I've never seen anything like this before." And that is not something that someone in Hong Kong would have said. And that inexperience goes back to what I was saying about the failure of imagination.
Well, I want to ask why, and I don't, my question is not why, like, okay, well, we didn't get the tests ready in time and leadership wasn't taking it seriously. Like, on a deep level, why? Why are we this way?
So I think there's two ways of looking at it. One is that no country can be fully prepared for a thing like this. It's just too sudden, too rare, too quick. So what preparedness really involves is being ready to spring into action when something like this happens. That is one of the ways in which we failed this time round, for the lack of testing, for the lack of coordinated leadership, for all of that. Most people I've spoken to who think about public health and preparedness talk about this concept of cycles of panic and neglect. So guess which one we're in now?
That sounds a lot like my day to day.
Right. that's, yes. And you know, it's our inability to think past a timescale that is typically the timescale of an electoral cycle that I think really hurts us when dealing with some of the massive systemic issues that face society today, whether it's planning for a pandemic or averting climate change. It's the same problem. And this is one of the things I wanted to deal with in the piece. Like, can we break that cycle? Like, are we doomed to forever repeating it? I look at the pandemic crisis
right
now.
What's the answer, yes or no? Did you figure it out? Are we doomed to repeat?
You know, the pessimist and maybe the realist in me is not hopeful. And that is so I look at this pandemic unfolding right now and I'm worried about the short-term deaths and losses that will ensue. But I'm already worried about like 5 years from now, whether we'll just slide back into the same vulnerable situation. The only reason I have for thinking that that might not be the case is a sort of perverse one, and it's that this catastrophe is really bad. It is on a scale that has affected all of the country, maybe all of the world, in a way that past disasters just have not.
There's no compartmentalizing it.
Absolutely. That might be the thing that shakes us out of this cyclical complacence.
Right. Yeah.
I was wondering, you know, it seems like when we put a defense frame on this, we are able to play into this same notion that we have an enormous military. We put like almost all of our money into the military. And I feel like most of our military, most of our defense system is just exorbitantly aired toward like the worst possible scenario. You know, except for here.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think the just the the disproportionate scale of spending in those two sectors, in military defense versus public health, is really striking. And I feel that's especially striking now. And I do wonder if that is a thing that will change in the future. This event has been compared by many people I've spoken to something like 9/11. And if anything, it is more significant than that. Like 9/11 was not mandatorily confining people to their homes, or at least not in a way that affected the entire country. Yeah. And if that caused such profound change in the nation's posture, such a radical shift towards counterterrorism as like the number one American priority, and of terrorists as the number one American fear, maybe this will do the same for public health and for pandemics as the possible threat. And I think everything boils down to what lessons are allowed to take hold over the next few months, and realistically, what happens in the election of this November. The way America reacts to that, whether it is seeing the enemy correctly, I think, as the disease, or whether incorrectly as the bearers of those disease based on the current situation, will radically influence the nation's foreign policy and its posture to the rest of the world going forward.
Right, right. So you envision three scenarios for how this ends.
Yep.
And I was wondering if you could quickly run through those.
Yeah, absolutely. So the three outcomes. So the first one is the unlikely one, and that is every country simultaneously controls their individual epidemics and the whole pandemic is closed down. It needs to be total and synchronous, and that is just so unlikely right now, given how much certain places are struggling. The second option is that the virus does more or less what the last flu pandemic of 2009 did, which is just sweep through the world, burn through the existing population. Some people die. People who survive become immune for a time. The virus can't find enough hosts to spread efficiently, and it just fizzles out. The cost of this scenario would be astonishingly terrible. And I think, again, we come back to this issue of imagination. I think some people are not quite grasping just how costly this scenario would be. Millions of deaths, either from the virus or from people who can't be treated for the usual set of heart attacks, strokes, all the rest, because hospitals can't deal with the virus. It means our healthcare system and our healthcare workforce will just collapse for the duration of the pandemic, and perhaps some time after as it needs to recover. It means doctors will start making choices like, do I let this patient die because that one might have a better chance of survival? Like this would be just such a moral and medical catastrophe. Like I just dread to think what this scenario actually would entail.
Yeah, I mean, we are already rationing in terms of tests and masks inside of hospitals, and that, like, doctors are getting orders not to wear masks except in very specific situations, even though in an ideal world right now, I would have everyone who comes into a hospital get tested and get a mask every day. So, like, that's early rationing. And in addition to in New York being told to, if you're feeling sick, just stay home if you can, which is like, you know, the advice is always consult your doctor, go to an emergency room if you feel sick. But no. So we're on this early stages of that. I hope it doesn't get to the point you're talking about, Ed. I mean, I'm sort of trying to play that out and how it would be handled in specific areas, like especially some rural hospitals. It seems inevitable there'll be at least some stories where an ICU just has to turn people away who clearly needed ICU care.
And you know, this is, and that goes to some of this future is kind of baked into place already, because the virus has this long fuse to it. Like, it takes a long time for the infections to actually show up, and then for the worst of those infections to play their course. So to an extent, the future is a little set. So the present is about mitigating the extent of the problems going forward, alleviating some of the signs that we're, like you say, we're already starting to see. So the final option, which I think is the best but also the most complicated, is that we play this protracted game of whack-a-mole with the virus over the course of at least a year, if not two, until a vaccine can be made, which means that people in different cities, states, countries try and stamp out their individual outbreaks, bring the virus under control, at which point perhaps social distancing measures can be relaxed. The virus may come back. It almost certainly will come back. But if we play this sort of adaptive game, like on and off again, it gives us time to do things like to ready enough protective equipment, to roll out widespread testing, to start developing antivirals, to develop tests to work out who might have standing immunity to the virus. All of those things can be done, but we have to get past the first wave, mm-hmm. and then we have to ready ourselves for kind of a long game.
So just tell me if I'm getting this right. There are kind of three options to how this could end. One is basically we missed our chance, which is squash it early.
That's right.
Two is what some people are seriously proposing right now is just like let it run its course. And that would mean horror on a scale that is difficult to imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly haven't seen in our lifetimes, but probably in generations, the scale of the horror and death would be, it talk about a failure of imagination. I definitely can't imagine how that would happen.
No, nor can I really.
So obviously that's bad.
Yeah.
And the third, which is the course we're on, is that we sort of do this cyclical stamping out of outbreaks and do it sort of in a scattered way, but we kind of put the brakes on it enough that the horror is limited until we can get a vaccine.
Yes, that's exactly it. That third solution is about spreading things out over time, minimizing the spikes that would overwhelm hospitals, and just buying ourselves enough time that more permanent countermeasures can be developed.
So it seems like even within the third scenario, there's a wide range of how that could go, right?
Right, yeah.
And I'm wondering how you both think that our failure of imagination is going to play into that. I mean, we're all anxious, right, to get back to life because we have such intolerance for what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's because we cannot imagine how bad it could be.
I think that's right. And I think this period right now, these couple of weeks are going to be challenging because people will start getting bored of social distancing. They'll start wondering why all this is necessary. Meanwhile, cases will still continue to climb. So it'll be a weird disconnect between people feeling like they've been subjected to weird draconian measures they don't understand, that also seem not to be doing anything because they won't have any immediate effect on the trajectory of the epidemic. And you will see pressure being placed on Trump and on leaders, both national and local, to lift these restrictions, to allow the economy to get back to normal, to allow people to return to their jobs and reopen their businesses. And at least for now, I think it's clear from every health expert I've spoken to that it's really important to stay the course. Like we need this time, and it's an unenviable position, but there's sort of not really a choice given where we've got to. And if those measures are enough, if we can get past that first wave, then we can start being cleverer and more precise and subtle, I think. But that requires a lot of the other things that we've talked about to be in place. The protective gear, the widespread testing, the serology tests to work out who has some degree of immunity. Those things need to happen before we start releasing our foot off the brakes. You can't do that in a situation where where like doctors have no masks, or where people are like using trash bags instead of gowns. That would just be it would be bad. It would be very bad.
You kind of both do this thing that I want to ask you about, where I feel like you're not saying the thing.
Someone wrote to us saying that about me.
It would be bad is such an undersell. And I know there is just basic professionalism is what you're displaying, but it's not that it would be bad. I mean, this is horrific. And sorry, I don't mean this in an accusatory way. I think it's an actual curiosity of mine. Like, even you as a journalist who has been covering this and knows intimately what could happen, like, is part of this too horrific to say out loud?
No, it's not that. I think I've two views on that. Firstly, many people currently in my inbox would disagree with you that I have been too restrained in my description of the future events. But I think, look, I think even now, panic does no one any good. I don't want people to panic. I want people to understand the gravity of the situation. So the piece I've wrote about talks about the various scenarios at play, the numbers that they might involve, and what absolutely must happen with some urgency. I can use as many superlatives as I like, as many graphic adjectives as I can pull out of my thesaurus. And I don't think that's going to be the thing that makes a difference. I think part of the response that I've had to this piece that I'm grateful of is that it's deliberately written so that it's not about inducing panic, but nor is it about offering false assurance. It's about calmly, but like accurately taking people through what might and what will happen and saying, here are our choices. And that's what I want to leave people with. Like, we still have an option. We still have options. We still have things we can do to avert the worst case scenarios. Here is what the worst case scenario is like. Here's how to get out of it. And I think that's all you can do. I think people can work out the scale of it for themselves by looking at the descriptions of it. And I think it's... I think that a citizenry that is informed but not despairing is one that is more likely to take action than one that is running around thinking that the sky is going to fall on their heads. You know, I want people to feel appropriately alarmed but also empowered.
I admire you both.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, Ed, I have one more question for you, and then we're going to let you go.
All right. Shoot.
Can you tell me about giraffes?
Yes.
Just everything.
Do you remember that giraffes
in the before exist? Times with giraffes? Okay. Giraffes are the tallest animals in the world. They are just faintly ridiculous. They have adapted to a life of verticality in ways that are just sort of hard to wrap your head around. One of my favorite giraffe trivia is that the skin on the legs is incredibly tight, kind of like compression socks, to stop blood from pooling at the bottom of the legs.
Giraffes have built-in compression socks.
Giraffes have built-in compression socks, right?
That is an excellent fact.
It's nice to momentarily think about something besides the virus.
I know, right?
I know when the last time I did that was.
Giraffes are amazing. Yeah. Let us remember, there may be a pandemic, but giraffes still exist.
They still exist.
Just don't forget that.
Yeah, they're out there.
And check out Ed's piece on giraffes.
Yes, please do. Yes, do that one too.
Ed is our resident expert on pandemics, how the world ends, and also giraffes. So check out all of his writing.
Yes, please. It turns out that releasing a piece about giraffes in the middle of a pandemic was maybe not the best feat of timing we could have ever engineered.
Read Ed's piece on giraffes because it's amazing.
Thanks, guys.
And they're still out there.
With their socks.
They don't care that we're having a pandemic. They're living their lives, being tall. Okay.
That concludes today's giraffe segment. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ed.
Right. Take care. Talk Be safe. Soon. Bye.
Bye. You too. Bye. Okay, so this show is produced by Kevin Townsend and Alvin Melleth with help from Anna Waters and Jacqueline Landry. Write us at socialdistance@theatlantic.com. Ed's pieces on pandemics and his excellent feature on giraffes, if you need to not think about the pandemic, are all on theatlantic.com. And the best way to support all of our journalism is with a subscription, which you can do at theatlantic.com/support us.
That's it. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Bye.
Bye.